Hello, everyone. This is Bill Knauer, and you're listening to Author to Author, where one writer talks to another writer about writing and life, because what it takes to write the book you most want to write is also what it takes to lead the life you most want to lead. Author to Author is brought to you by Author Magazine, the premier free writing magazine on the internet, featuring articles on writing and the writing life, as well as video and audio interviews with best-selling and award-winning authors across the genres. You can find Author Magazine at authormagazine.org, and we are funded by the Great Pacific Northwest Writers Association, supporting writers from pen to publication since 1955. If you want to join the PNWA or just learn about their fabulous yearly writers conference, please go to pnwa.org. You know, it's a funny thing. I've found myself, this always seems to happen, things happen in waves. And lately I've found myself talking more and more with authors about identity. I found myself talking to Alex Espinoza about it a couple of weeks ago on this show. His parents had been born in Mexico, and he grew up in America. And I talked to Jenny Shortridge about it, and you'll be able to watch that interview in a couple of weeks on the magazine, because her protagonist in her book had lost her memory. And I expect I will talk to today's guest, Henriette Lazaridis Power, about this subject as well. She may have been born in Boston, but her parents emigrated from Greece, and she spoke Greek in her house, and so was essentially living in two worlds, that of her Greek house and her very American outer world. And she's written a book about it as well, or at least dealing with that subject, The Clover House, just out today, that asks, among other things, who are you? Who are you? It's a very good question. The more you ask it, the more you peel back that onion, the more you just keep asking it, who are you? And who, for that matter, is Henriette Lazaridis Power? Let's find out. Henriette, welcome to the show.
Thanks for having me, Bill.
Well, it's good to have you. Congratulations. This is it today. The Clover House is out and in stores, yes?
Yes, that is true.
That is
the day
awesome.
Has finally come.
Oh, it seems like a long wait, doesn't it?
Sometimes, yeah.
Yeah? When did you sell it? Did you sell it a year ago?
Actually, in November of 2010.
Yikes.
So, a little over almost 2.5 years ago.
Yeah, oh boy, okay. Yeah. And this is your first published novel.
Yes.
Is that right? Okay, but you had a career before this as an academic. You taught and were dean at a little college in Cambridge called Harvard.
Yes,
how was that transition from academia to the creative world?
Well, it was harder than I thought. I had always intended to be a writer, and I had gone through college with the completely clear vision that after I graduated I would be involved in publishing in some way, and I would be working on my novels on the side. And then I sort of ended up, one thing led to another, and I ended up with a PhD, and I was teaching, and I was an academic, which I really enjoyed. But then at some point in the mid-90s, I kind of had a V8 moment and realized, wait a second, what happened to the fiction? Because I really enjoyed writing scholarly papers, but what I realized that what I enjoyed was any opportunity I had to be creative, which, of course, one can be in any scholarly paper, but it's sort of...
It's different.
There was a little voice that was telling me that I needed to do a different kind of creativity.
Yeah.
And when I was able to quit about 1998, I thought it would be seamless. I thought I would just jump into this other world. And, in fact, it took me a few years to take myself seriously as a novelist and put in the kind of risk-taking effort that you need to put in order to do your best work in any field, really, but certainly I was kind of holding back, so it took me a little bit of time.
You know, I've never been an academic. I would always think, and I've interviewed a few academic-turned-novelists, and I've never quite gotten an answer to this, because I guess I've never asked it, but it seems to me, so your academic work was in literature, was it largely or
mm-hmm.
exclusively?
Exclusively.
All right. So you were writing about Joyce and Faulkner
yeah.
and whoever else, right?
Right. And actually, at some point, I remember when I was in my, I guess still in my early to mid-20s, my parents' friends would say, oh, but I thought you were going to be a writer. And my line at the time was, I decided I wasn't good enough to write my own fiction, so I'll just write about other people's.
Oh, boy. Okay, so first,
first
job is to untell that story that you've been telling for the last 10 years, right?
Right.
Oh, boy. I'm not good enough. All right, moreover, you've been sitting there. See, I think this is always tricky, is you spent a number of years in the position of talking about creative work, analyzing
right.
it, discussing it, and I think you've got to completely leave – well, okay, I'm going to let you say it, but I think you have to leave that frame of mind to then do the creative work itself. It's a whole different point of view on it.
It is, and it's especially what I found was, of course, the way I would read things – had to change completely. It was a real treat when I first stopped teaching to read books without a pen in my hand, which I miss. I mean, I still pick up a pen and annotate, of course, but I always had to have a pen in my hand because I always had to be jotting stuff down and underlining and marking passages. And then also, I was reading books suddenly by people who were alive, which was such a
big difference, huh?
Or, you know, to take nothing away from Dickens, who I love, it was nice to give myself license to read things by writers who were affecting literature
right.
today, and then to read differently, to read not for the underlying subtext or what's going on with messages about imperialism in this Victorian novel,
right.
but to look at how character and pacing and dialogue and all those elements of novelistic craft were being handled by the writer.
Yes. And also, I think that once you start doing the work creatively, you understand the degree that the strange relationship you have with your imagination, where things happen that some things you plan, a lot of things I would assume happen that you did not plan.
Oh, yeah. Yeah.
And those are delightful
parts. And you look at something afterwards and you see that you've done something. That there's a theme or some sort of recurring phrase or, well, hopefully not a recurring phrase in a repetitive
right.
sense, but something that's there. And then you can see if you want to work with that. But
right.
but I did find that there were elements in the Clover House that sort of got in there without my noticing.
Yes, and you know, and what's interesting, at least it must have been interesting to look back at the work you had been analyzing now, knowing that that was happening to Dickens, and it was happening
mm-hmm.
to Joyce, and it was happening to Shakespeare,
mm-hmm.
it was happening to all of them.
Right. And actually, one of the things that I love is I have this facsimile edition of Dickens' notes for his novels. It's not all of the novels, but there's a selection of a handful of them. And it's wonderful to look at the notes that he made and see where he has a dialogue with himself where he'll say, work in Guppy, you know, the name of a character,
right.
and then he'll say, no. And you can see other things where he's discovered something. And so three
right.
chapters later in his notes, he's like, oh, yeah, that thing that I wrote back then,
yeah.
I want to use that.
Yeah.
So.
Yeah, well, it's very I really do believe it is a once you get into the experience, it's a relationship you're having with this thing, presence, muse, imagination, more than, say, you thinking it through. There's something that's being given to you that you're working with. At least that's how I've always experienced it.
Well, yeah,
I think there is that.
I think there is that, but I'm also really mindful. I know that there, and this isn't exactly what you're saying, but there's that other pitfall of the muse where people think that they have to wait for the muse to guide them. And that's a separate issue. It's like you have to just sit in the chair and you have to do the work. And to me, sometimes it feels as though every time I sit down to write, it's this wonderful opportunity to solve a puzzle. Like, let's identify what the puzzle is right now, and let's think what's the best way to get through it or to resolve it in a pleasing way. And
right.
so I guess, I mean, that's deliberate thinking. But then, sure, you write a word down. I mean, the character, actually, the protagonist of the Clover House, is who she is because I wrote a sentence that turned out a particular way. And when I finished writing it, I thought, oh, all right, well, that's who she'll be then.
Right.
And
yeah.
that's exactly what happened. I didn't set out to write the character to be the way she is, but I just wrote a sentence.
Yes, but that's so much more, such a more secure place to write from, because it feels like, the way I've always described it is, you are observing something that seems to already exist, and so instead of you trying to create something that didn't exist, it's almost like you found it. Oh, look, there it is. That's what she is.
Yeah.
How I know.
Yeah.
You know, and then
but I think isn't it kind of both? I mean, to me, I sort of imagine it, like, here's what I see, and then it's a question of, now the problem to solve is, how do I get that on paper? How do I convey that in words? Because I see it in pictures first.
Right.
So
that's the translation.
Now,
that's your job, the translation.
Yeah.
The translation. That's what writing is. But it comes to you first, and then you translate it. And the word I always try to shoot for is, instead of using the phrase good writing, is accurate. Can you be accurate to what you've written, to what you've seen? Because only you can see it. I can't see it.
Yeah, that's right. That makes sense to me. I think that's a good way of looking at it.
Well, so you've got your character. You found her in this sentence, and we are. And you were an academic. Now you are a novelist. Your parents were Greek. So identity. Identity. Have you ever seen? There's a very funny thing where Deepak Chopra is sitting with Conan O'Brien, and he says, "Who are you?" And he says, "I'm Conan O'Brien." He says, "Who are you? I'm a comedian. Who are you?" He says, "I'm Popeye the Sailor Man." So it goes on and on and on like this. And that's what I think of when I think of the question, "Who are you?" It seems like an onion you can just keep peeling back. What does that mean to you when I say, "Who are you?"
Oh, that is the question.
That's a big one, huh?
It is. It really is. Because, I mean, for me specifically, when I'm here, oh gosh, I can't even form the answer properly, but I think that when I am here, I'm sort of mindful that I'm essentially Greek. And when I'm in Greece, I'm not so much mindful that I'm essentially American, because I don't actually think that's true, but I'm mindful that I'm not essentially Greek. It sort of shifts depending on what language I'm speaking and where I am and that kind of thing. And it's a complicated thing. There's a Greek concept for it that I go to often. It's xenikia is the word, and it kind of means a self-imposed exile, which is very common among many, many Greeks are emigrants from their country. There's a long history of that, and so a lot of Greeks have chosen this xenikia, where they have exiled themselves from a land that they have a constant nostalgia for. And for me, if my identity comes down to one thing, it's that I am the one who is constantly experiencing nostalgia for the place that she is not in and for the culture that she is not a part of.
But that's an excellent position for a novelist. Nostalgia works well in fiction sometimes for whatever reason. It's that imagining of that other thing, of that place, of that time.
Yeah, yeah. It's sort of pulling it out of the past imaginatively.
Yeah.
Into your present.
Yeah.
Which
and
is,
so
I think,
you
one
see
of the reasons.
No, go ahead. Sorry.
No,
well, okay, I'll go ahead. So I was going to say that
you
see yourself as Greek, but what does that mean? So I'm American. I've only ever lived in America. I wouldn't even know. I wouldn't even know what I'm not if I. But so you see yourself, even though you were born and raised in America, some part of you feels essentially Greek. What does that mean?
Well,
describe that to me.
I wish I had the answer, but I think I'm not very good at expressing this, but it becomes clear to me, I sort of realize, I'm not really, as my husband once said to me, he said, "You're not really from here," because there was something I had done or said that was just not from here, and sometimes it's quite clearly something that I'll do with language. I'm a renowned mangler of idioms. Every day I screw something up. It's terrible. There are things about American culture that still fascinate me the way I guess someone from another country would be fascinated by them. I don't know. But Greek culture, I'm going to stereotype now a little bit, but there's a different way of expressing your emotions. There's a different way of, certainly, of relating to other people. Personal space not much of it. privacy,
right.
Not much of it.
Yeah.
The way in which people interact is, it's often pitched at a higher level of intensity. People often think the Greeks are arguing when they're just having a normal conversation.
My brother, he dated a woman whose family was, so we're very sort of, I guess, WASPy, as we come from the East Coast, and so that's sort of my upbringing. And he married a woman who was actually a conservative Jewish family, and they were. And he went to dinner with them once, and he finished the dinner. He said, "What was wrong with you people? What were you doing? That was the worst." He says, "What? We were just talking to each other." So that was an argument.
Yeah.
He said, "No, that was just conversation. What are you talking
right.
about?"
Right, right. Yeah, that's,
it sounds
that's
like
fairly,
the same sort of thing.
Yeah, that's a fairly common experience for Greeks being overheard someplace.
But, you know, I think which Outsider is a good place for a writer to start from, actually. Though it can be a little lonely, it's... That observer is not a bad position for a novelist.
Yeah, it isn't. It isn't. I mean, it's sort of like being a photographer who's not participating in the action, but who can step a little bit outside it and look in. Which isn't to say that somebody who isn't a complete insider in his or her culture can't be an amazing writer and can't adopt that outsider stance. But it's sort of, yeah. I think it is kind of built in when you grow up with a foot in two different countries.
You know, I was reading your...
Partly, you're always trying to sort of, you're always learning. I mean, some things, of course, come instinctively. You live in America, you talk a certain way, you do what you do. And the same when I go to Greece, people don't know that people often think that if I'm in a taxi from the airport, they think I'm coming home. They
right.
can't tell.
Right.
Or they think maybe I live abroad or something and I'm coming home to visit, which I guess is technically, in a way, sometimes the case. But I do feel like I'm always learning, and I sort of lost my train of thought, but learning things about the culture, things about how to be in the culture. That's
You're talking
going
about
on.
America now or Greece?
Well...
Or both?
Probably both. Probably
yeah.
both. I mean, yeah. I think
you know what, though? Be. I still feel like I'm learning how to be in this culture, and that's the only one I've ever been in. So maybe that's a lifelong thing for all human beings in some way.
Yeah, I think that's the thing, is that I've been sort of thinking about this more lately and thought, well, some of this does have to do with the fact that you grew up bilingual and you shuttled between
yeah.
two countries, but some of it is just who you are.
Yeah.
Regardless. So.
Yeah, you know, my mother read me this. She was a fan of this mystery series, and I don't remember who it was. It might have been McDonald. But anyway, it was back when I was a teenager, and she read this chapter, this little scene to me. She said, "Don't you love this?" And I guess the detective had a kind of wise friend who accompanied him. And at one point, the detective turned to the wise friend and said, "You know, I sometimes feel like everybody is hovered around, I'm paraphrasing, but everybody's gathered around a campfire, and I'm at the edge of the clearing looking in on it." And the wise friend turned to him and said, "Don't you realize everybody feels that way?" And
yeah.
I think to some degree we all do a little bit.
Yeah.
You know, some more than others.
It's like when you go to a high school reunion and you discover that the people you thought had it all together were just
yeah.
as insecure as you were.
Yeah. Oh, absolutely. And you know, it's funny, you were talking about I was thinking of the blog you wrote about the word a little water or small. What is
oh,
the,
yeah.
What was the phrase?
Yeah, a little water. Neraki, a little water.
But it's almost like a tender reference to water.
It is.
Not an amount, necessarily. But
right,
that's a
exactly.
unique thing to Greek language that requires a whole two sentences to give in English, but it exists in one word or two words in Greek.
Right. This is the thing that I think is... A very unique thing about the way Greeks use their language. I mean, that thing, like to say neraki instead of nero to ask for water, is just an idiomatic thing. But Greeks are also so creatively playful with their language. So much of Greek humor on any given day, like the in jokes that people are passing around, have to do with verbal inventions.
Mm.
Greeks love to invent stuff with words, and it's you don't have to be a literate Greek to do it. Anybody does it, and
right.
I think that's there's a way in which speaking is very alive in Greek culture. And when someone says, you know, I'd like a little neragi, they're very aware that they're saying this particular sort of affectionate, that they're using this very affectionate term,
right,
to ask for a glass of water.
Yeah. Yeah, and, you know, I wondered if, did you come to writing through speaking, as in storytelling, around the dinner table or wherever? Yeah, opposed to just your journal, though maybe that too, but.
Well, both, yeah, but I think this is part of, every family has this, people tell stories around the table, but I think especially, maybe because I was growing up away from my parents' native land, they were always telling me, this is what we did when we were children, and we had this adventure, and of course they had both grown up during the Second World War, my father occupied by Germans, and my mother occupied by the Italians, and so a lot of the stories that I craved to listen to, I would ask them, you know, tell me what happened during the war, what happened when you did this with your bicycle, and so I did hear tons of stories all the time.
Yeah.
My first bedtime stories, my father would tell me stories from the Odyssey.
Wow.
That's what I grew up with.
Wow.
Yeah.
Pretty cool.
I know. Cool.
It's from Homer to him to you, huh?
Yeah.
Passed right on down. Well, you know, I always wonder about that because I know it's different to write, but I know I was influenced by having to tell people stories and having a story told to me, the need to sort of make it compact because you can't go on and on in a spoken story. You've got to try to get to the point reasonably soon. Mm-hmm. And it's a good discipline. It's a good discipline for narrative writing, it seems to me.
That's true. I think it's a discipline I wish I had more of because whenever I'm just trying to give an example of something or just in normal conversation, I always tell a story that's much longer than it needs to be.
Oh, really?
It's like, you don't even need the story. All I need to do is say I'm going to the store, but I might throw a whole story in there.
A storyteller's gene, too. You want to fill it in and make it rich. Well, good, too, because you've written this beautiful novel. By the way, I didn't get a chance to praise you on it. It's a lovely book. I encourage you all
to
pick it up. The Clover House is a great debut. Was it for you? You're welcome. And I'm curious about how long did it take you before you said, I'm allowed now to speak instead of speaking about? How long did it take for you to claim that authority?
With the narrative of the Clover House in particular, or just in general?
Well, just in general, because it took you 10 years, it seems, from when you left academia to when you, well, over that, 12 years to sell this. So.
Oh, yeah. Thanks for reminding me.
But that's not so, no, but that, believe me, that's a rather normal amount of time to actually find the chops to do it. There's nothing new to that.
Yeah.
So what was it like for you, making that transition?
It was hard. I think it was harder than I realized because what I thought I was just sort of going along, and you know, I'd come out of academia, I had a successful career, and I had come through a world in which you finished a paper, you submitted it for a conference, you got immediate feedback, boom, done, move on to the next thing. And now here was this world where you could toil away for months and years and send something out and then take a long time to hear back, and you know, feedback was pretty thin on the ground, and that was very difficult. And I think I was kind of ticking along, maybe better than average, but nothing really special for 8 or 9 years.
Yeah.
I mean, you know, doing okay, but nothing really great. And then I had a couple of sort of events that gave me the kick in the pants that I needed to really take myself seriously and realize that you have to put it all on the line. You have to take risks, and there is no guarantee. And if you care about it enough, you have to go forward knowing there's no guarantee. And that, I think, made a huge difference. That once I made that decision to just go for it, then I found ways to get feedback. I found ways to get better, and it sort of went on from there. But it did take me a long time. I was kind of apologizing for my own behavior without really realizing it.
Oh. What part of your behavior were you apologizing for?
The fact that I was trying to write. I was sort of like, oh, well, you know, I'm doing this thing, but it's not going
it's hard.
Anywhere.
If you go get your PhD, you've gotten your PhD, and there it is, you know. And
right.
You have it forevermore. But with the writing, as you said, there is no guarantee. And so you really have to believe in it without any proof whatsoever.
Right. And I don't think I realized that in 1998 when I decided to walk away. I think I sort of thought I knew that I was walking away from reference points and the context and some sense of status, you know, where you rank in the university and that kind of thing.
Yeah.
I think I thought I knew what it was, but it's very different.
I'm sorry, but you said something earlier, which was, as you're talking about making that transition, where you said you realize you have to take risks. What mm-hmm. were some of those risks that you had to take?
Well, generally, putting in the amount of time that you really need to put in, sort of not getting up and walking away from the desk because it's just much easier. Then you can say, well, I only put in 2 hours, so it's okay that the work isn't as good as it could be.
Right.
If you put in 7 or 8 hours and you then
whoa,
you, really,
you did seven
then, you know,
or eight?
Well, no, and I don't mean that once. I'm just
okay.
saying hypothetically.
Right. Okay. That's
a
lot.
You fry your brain. but for me, kind of experimenting a little bit with the voice that I was trying to use and feeling a little freer about the style that I would adopt, feeling a little freer to not stop at every sentence and revise. I had been writing a different manuscript that didn't have very much dialogue, and the Clover House has a fair amount of dialogue, and
yeah.
I just sort of let myself go with that, and that was a change for me, and I remember telling friends, you know, I don't know what's going on with this novel. There's all this dialogue. But then sort of not changing course and holding back on that and saying, well, this is what I want to try. This is where I need to go. It doesn't sound very innovative and edgy to say,
took
a risk. I used a lot of dialogue.
No,
but for me, it
matter.
Was.
Yeah. It doesn't matter. I'll tell you, when you find your voice, it's a big deal, because if you find it, that means you've heard things similar to it, but hopefully you've never heard it before. And obviously that's refreshing, but at the same time, if you've never heard it before, you have no idea where it will land, how it will be received. And so there's automatically, you introduce a whole unknown, which, you know, maybe come from the world of universities you weren't as accustomed to. But that's the excitement, and that's the danger.
Right. And when you talk about excitement and danger, I mean, there's something about, like, the intensity of the emotions that you're dealing with when you're writing a novel. Whether they come out intensely in the prose or not, that may depend on the kind of book that you're writing. But I do think that writing is a lot like acting. And when you're sitting in your room by yourself, you have to inhabit whatever role it is. And to do it well, I think, you have to really inhabit the role completely. I don't mean go out and live the way your character lives, but you have to feel it. You have to feel those emotions in order to be able to get them on paper.
That is so true, Henriette, and I wish I could talk more about that very subject, because I'm quite... Oh, but someone's telling me we've only got a minute left. Listen, good luck. I know it just came out today, The Clover House. Thank you so much, Henriette.
Thank you, Bill. It's been a pleasure talking to you.
Oh, it's been nice talking to you. And look at that. We got to meet Henriette. Isn't she great? Go out and buy her book. It's outstanding. You will not be disappointed. Until then, take a risk, everybody. Take a risk. The worst that will happen is you will be surprised. Maybe good, maybe bad. Doesn't matter. As Shakespeare said, nothing on heaven or earth is good or bad, but thinking makes it so. It's true. Until next week, I think it's just going to be me next week, talking about writing within yourself. Until then, well, do something you love. Talk to someone you love. Read something you love.